This is Cade Massey, practice professor at the Wharton School. On this week's Wharton Moneyball Highlight Show, we have a conversation with economist and author Seth Stevens Davidowitz. If you think economists are boring, Seth certainly is not. He's got a new book called Who Makes the NBA? He uses data to dive into some fun questions that he's been curious about as an NBA fan, and he does it all using AI. And so his book stands as kind of a primer and a portal to those who haven't been coding but might use AI to do some statistical analysis. Great fun on the NBA, great fun on data analysis, and super interesting on AI. This is Seth Stevens Davidowitz.
From the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School, this is Wharton Moneyball on Business Radio.
Welcome. Welcome to Wharton Moneyball here on Sirius XM. This is Cade Massey hosting today with my longtime collaborator, friend, co-host, faculty colleague, Eric Bradlow. Our two other co-hosts are out and about doing Shane and Audie things. They will be back sometime in the future. We have a first-time guest, Seth Stevens Davidowitz, is joining us this week. We know Seth. We've known Seth for a number of years now. In fact, he visited as a professor here a number of years ago in my home department of operations, information, and decisions. Delighted to have Seth back. He's a data scientist. He's an economist with a PhD in economics from Harvard. He's an author. He has a best-selling book called Everybody Lies, as well as a new book. He's got a second one. What's the second one floating around here? Help me out, Seth.
Don't Trust Your Gut.
Don't Trust Your Gut. After Everybody Lies, he wrote a book called Don't Trust Your Gut. And he has a third book out, which is what we want to talk about today, entitled Who Makes the NBA? It is a deep dive into analytics to answer some fun and interesting questions about the NBA. And he writes it in an intriguing way. Lots to talk about with Seth. Thanks for making time, Seth, and welcome to Wharton Moneyball.
Thanks so much for having me, Kate. I miss you. I remember showing up at Wharton. I think my little office was across the way from yours, and we'd talk about what happened in the football the week before. I remember.
No, don't tell them that. We were talking about deep questions about, I don't know, global health or something. we might have had a few football conversations. Seth, you have 10 chapters in here, each a different question. I want to raise just a couple, and I'm sure it can take us to other parts of the book. Let's just focus on three real quick. Number one is height adjusting players. This is a fun exercise. It's kind of a silly exercise at some level, but it's provocative. So what Seth does here is he's like, look, some people are more successful in the NBA because they're taller. Let's do something that we're forever trying to do in sports analytics, which is like, let's normalize for some factor, except in this case, he's going to normalize for a physical factor, your height. What happens if we normalize for people's height, players' height, and then evaluate them? Like, what do we see? So can you talk a little bit about this and what you learned from doing this and tell us about I don't know how much of a story we need, but your acronym for these, the unit you used was Muggsies. Named after someone who emerges at the top of your chart.
Well, and the fun thing about that is another great use of ChatGPT. I need to name this metric, and I named it Muggsies. I'm like, it'd be great if it was an acronym, or I guess it's called a backronym, apparently. It'd be fun if it stood for something, but I'm not great at coming up with things it would stand for. So I asked ChatGPT, and it came up with Muggsies stands for Metric for Understanding Game Given Sporting Individuals Effectiveness and Size, which is just perfect. Amazing. Right. That's like so good. I would have never come up with that in a million years.
You know
years.
Why you wouldn't have come up with it? Because you never would have referred to a player as a sporting individual.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, it's just not in my head, but it works.
Okay, so tell us about Muggsies and tell us what emerges.
So first of all, the motivation is just, you know, I think people realize, obviously, height is important in the NBA. You kind of have to be blind not to realize that tall people are disproportionately NBA players. But I think people don't realize just how much it matters. So each inch roughly doubles your chances of making the NBA throughout the height distribution. So if you're 6 feet tall, you have twice the chance as if you're 5'11". If you're 6'1", you have twice the chance if you're 6 feet. All the way, if you're 7 feet, you have twice the chance as if you're 6'11". What this means is you're 7 feet or above, you have something like a 1 in 7 chance of reaching the NBA. Which is just insane.
Now, I've heard that, by the way, I've heard that before. Just to be clear, this is amongst the general population of all people in the world. Like, it's not like if I took all college players, this is an important question for our listeners here on Wharton Moneyball. If I took all college players, it wouldn't be that extreme, right?
No, if you took all college players, it'd be more extreme. So it's one in seven in the population. So if you got the people who already became a college player, there are seven people.
My comment is, let's say, I just want to make sure you mentioned doubling. So there's 12 height inches between 6 feet and 7 feet. If it's a doubling, it would be 2 raised to the power 12, which would be something like 4,000 to 1. It's not 4,000 times more likely that a 7-footer in college will make the
pro than a 6-footer okay, yes. In college. So once you've already reached college.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, exactly. So that would correct it.
Yes.
You'd be corrected to some extent. So the 6-foot player in college has already proven themselves in a way, so would have a chance, chance. Yeah, exactly.
Seth, before we go any further, let me real quickly play a little game with Eric, because Eric has not yet read the book, but he knows more about the NBA than I do. Eric, and this is, we're going to go right at the most provocative thing here.
All right.
You know, everybody knows who most people consider the greatest basketball player of all time, and certainly of our generation, so we're all biased that way, Michael Jordan. Where on Seth's new list, top 10 height adjusted or lower, top 10 height adjusted, top height adjusted players in NBA history, where do you think Michael Jordan ends up? Michael Jordan was 6'6", by the way.
That's interesting, because he was so great and he's not overly tall. So he's got to be somewhere in the top five.
He comes in at nine. He comes in at nine.
That's perfect answer, because, you know, and that's where Kareem Abdul-Jabbar ranks.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so Kareem, one could easily argue, is the greatest player of all time. I would argue, you know, same number of championships as Jordan, more MVPs than Jordan, one with two different teams. You know, I could say lots of things, you know, obviously had more rebounds, et cetera. Kareem has to be, I don't know, 40? I don't know.
No. He's 7'2", and just consider the advantages you have versus the shorter guys. He comes in at space 2,244. Seth takes Kareem down. Wow. The legend of Bill Russell goes down, 1,419. I mean, Seth's brutal on these guys. I mean, it's kind of a revenge. Seth might be, you know, vertically challenged himself. It may be a big revenge play. I don't know.
I enjoyed it as a 5'9", passionate basketball player who never even made it to my freshman basketball team. There was a little bit of revenge of the short person here. But one of the things you see in basketball.
Is Tiny Archibald number one?
No, Muggsy.
I was going to say Muggsy. That was going to be my other.
Okay, Aaron, well, see, they at 5'3", right? But let me ask you another question. Of currently active players, who do you think's highest on the list? Well-known currently active player who's highest on the list.
Steph Curry.
How tall is Steph?
Like 6'2"?
You get a lot of action. He's probably coded as taller than that. He get a lot of action off of height here. Keep going. You got it. In fact, you don't have to go very far from Seth.
I don't know. It's somebody on the Warriors.
Who's the shortest top player on the Warriors right now? He hasn't been on there very long, to be fair.
The shortest top. Oh, Chris Paul.
Yeah. Chris Paul, number two. 6 feet. Number two on the list.
So one of the things that you see in the data that I also put, I have a whole bunch of charts of this, is this kind of gets to the point that Kareem height adjusted is not that great. And, you know, some of these players are ranked much lower. Is among NBA players, there is a shocking negative relationship between height and ability on anything else. So height and vertical leap, you know, how high you can get off the ground. The taller players just leap way less than the shorter players. Height and speed, you know, three quarters court ran at the combine, huge, you know, that'll be a positive, just much slower. The taller players, much slower. Height and free throw percentage, height and 3-point percentage, height even, and how much you can bench press. This was shocking that the taller players bench press less than the shorter players. And the reason for this is you just don't have to be as good, because you get this height is such an advantage that if you're 6 feet tall in the NBA, if you're Chris Paul, you're competing with millions, tens of millions of other men for your spot.
The choking chapter is awesome, because we talk a lot about choking, and, you know, there's always an open question about is clutchiness a thing? And you use free throw shooting to kind of get at this. So tell us about what you found in free throw shooting clutching.
Yeah, so it's really hard to measure clutch shooting, because, you know, so many shots are different. So, you know, Kobe Bryant has a very low percentage of last second shots, but a lot of times he takes crazy shots because he never passed the ball at the end of games. So you take these wild three pointers and they're very low field goal percentage. Is that because he was nervous or he can't handle the pressure or just because the shots were worse? And free throws are a great way to test this because it's the same, you know, the same distance, no defender. And you can compare, you know, what happens in a clutch moment, 5 minutes or less to go in the game, within 5 points to other free throws. And you see the average NBA player shoots about one percentage point worse in clutch moments and about 1.8 percentage points worse in clutch moments in playoff games. And that's true controlling for fatigue in various ways you control for it.
That's what I was going to ask you, if you controlled for fatigue.
Yeah. And one of the things that it's kind of surprising because one of the great, you know, Moneyball revolutions in baseball is kind of getting rid of the idea of clutch performance in general, either positive or negative. And one of the ideas is to get to the top of a league, you know, to reach the majors, the professionals, you have to be so good, so mentally tough that you can't really be a choker, right? If you're a choker, you're not going to make it probably to college, let alone the pros, if you can't handle pressure. But in the NBA, I think it's very clear that there is such a thing as choking. And I tried to figure out what is it about the chokers versus the non-chokers, because there are a whole bunch of players who are exactly the same in clutch moments and not clutch moments.
Well, so Seth, this is, don't run too quickly past this point. The average is a one percentage decrement in performance, but there's heterogeneity. And you point out that some people no decrement at all, and then some are really choking, essentially. And so
enormous. So some players just absolutely zero difference between their, you know, how they perform during clutch moments and non-clutch moments. Then you have players like Vin Baker, who has, I think, was 16 percentage points worse in the clutch than non-clutch. Tim Duncan surprised some people, very big drop in clutch moments. David Robinson had a big drop in clutch moments. Arvydas Sabonis, you kind of see a whole bunch of players where the difference is just enormous. And I was trying to figure out what is it about these players. And I tested a billion theories. I even tested their family backgrounds. There's a theory, Jimmy Butler, who's amazing in the clutch by my metric or just about any metric. Jimmy Butler's so good in the clutch moments because he had such a difficult childhood. So I don't know if people know the story of Jimmy Butler. His dad abandoned the family when he was young. His mom abandoned him as well. So he's abandoned by both parents. He's just been through a horrible situation, you know, terrible neighborhood, drugs, crime, everything. And there's an idea that once he's been through that, who the hell cares that millions of people are watching you shooting a free throw? You know, once you've been through that, you'll be through anything. Well, it turns out family background does not influence clutch shooting. The only thing I could find that influenced clutch shooting was height, a huge statistically significant effect that taller players, I mentioned Tim Duncan, Arvydas Sabonis, David Robinson, Vin Baker, much worse clutch shooters. And I think it follows directly from the value of height in the NBA that, again, because height is such an advantage, you just don't have to be as good at everything else. So if you were 6 foot tall and you couldn't shoot in the clutch, you would not make the NBA. There are just too many other 6 feet tall people out there who are good in the clutch who will take your spot. If you're 7 foot tall, 7'1", 7'2", 7'3", you're just competing against dozens of men. You don't have to be the most mentally tough person on the planet. You don't have to be remarkably able to handle pressure. So it was an enormous difference that the average 6 foot or below player shoots clutch free throws and non-clutch free throws at exactly the same rate. The average 7 foot or above player shoots clutch free throws at 6.8 percentage points worse than non-clutch moments. So just a huge difference. And you know, I know this as a lifelong New York Knicks fan. I mean, it was a joke how bad Patrick Ewing was in the clutch. I mean, it's laughable.
I want to note the similarity between the story that you investigated that didn't pan out versus the story that you find panning out. And that is what they had to survive and fight through in order to get to where they are. I mean, the tough childhood is a version of that same story, right? It's like they came through tough circumstances. Well, competing as a 6 footer through high school, you know, college, pro, that's the same kind of tough struggle. It has the same selection effects that economists will be looking for.
When you said the number 1% and then 1.8%, I'll use the Yiddish expression here. That sounds like bupkis to me. I understand it's an average and there's heterogeneity. Like, if so, like, here's my question. Of all the things you could have somebody work on, suppose I could say to you, you know, you shoot 75% from the line in the first 43 minutes of the game, and the last 5 minutes of the game, when the game's close, you shoot 73%. Or I could make you turn over the ball less. Or I could make you pass the ball better. Or I could make you give up less offensive rebounds. Or I could make you foul less. Where do you think this effect size would fit into the things of, I need to see what predicts winning, and how large is this compared to the other factors?
It's a great question, Eric. I think one of the things I'd say is I assume this is a proxy for inability to handle pressure more generally. So the fact that someone is 1 percentage point worse in free throws, they're also more likely to turn over the ball, also more likely to accidentally step on the line and go out of bounds.
As a statistician and someone that worked for ETS for years, this is exactly the kind of thing we're interested in. Is there a single unidimensional scale for clutchness, or is it more multidimensional? Kate obviously works a lot with both people analytics and training. This is the same question that people ask in lots of different domains.
So I didn't test it. One of the frustrating things when you're a huge basketball fan is it's very hard to be fully done with a book because you answer 10 questions and you have 10 more questions that you want to look at. So one of the things I'm interested in is...
That's a good problem.
Yeah, it's a good problem. But you know, I'd love to look at, does this correlate with other measures of clutch performance? But those would be a lot harder to measure in various ways. But my guess is that someone who is bad at free throws, also bad at shooting threes, also more likely to turn the ball over in the last second. The other thing about basketball is the last minutes of the game really do count a lot more than the first minutes of the game. You see this in if you watch the odds on games. So if you know someone, if a team's ahead, let's say the teams were the game was pick-up before the game started, and then at halftime, one team's ahead by 10 points. If each minute counted equally, they'd now be 10-point favorites going forward, right? Like to win in the final, at the end of the game, they're up by 10. The teams were evenly matched. We'd expect them to win by 10 points. If you actually look at the spread, they're more like 4 or 5-point favorites at this point. So those first minutes just have a hugely less value in basketball. Teams tend to be able to catch up, you know, for whatever reason. The last moments of the game just really do have much more value in basketball. So I do think clutch shooting, ability to handle pressure would be a place I'd put a lot of emphasis.
All right, let's go to the third and final example from the book for this discussion anyway, and that was coaching. I think it may be the last chapter in the book where you ask, are some coaches making a bigger difference than others? And it's a fun chapter in general because you even allude to research that compares the impact of coaches across a major professional sport. And you echo the conclusion others have had, which is that NBA coaches make the biggest difference.
Well,
go ahead.
It's actually interesting. I'd be curious, as you guys in the space of sports analytics, I'm surprised the relative energy that goes into measuring the players and the coaches in analytics. Like, it's kind of surprising. I mean, there's so much energy into measuring, you know, how we can really measure a player's contribution in every sport. And you compare that, you know, you look up very quickly a player in any sport. Now there are all kinds of advanced analytics, value over replacement player, et cetera. If you look up coaches, it's basically win percentage, and that's about it. There's so much less emphasis. It kind of seems like a ripe area for me for sports analytics to go into. I'd be curious what you think about that.
We're 100% with you. Coaching analytics, we love it anytime we see it. It's one of the reasons I'm picking the chapter to talk about briefly. It's challenging, obviously. And a lot of times the field hasn't gotten there yet. We usually just kind of throw everything we can't model into ERA or, you know, the residual. And a lot of coaching models you see are just taking the residual. And so, the coaches are in there somewhere, but so is a lot of other stuff. And turn it around, my collaborator, longtime friend, former student Rufus Peabody will say about, you know, NFL analytics, once you've got a really good model for a team's performance, it's not like coaching just lives outside of that. A lot of the coaching is going through the factors that you have in your model. And so it really is hard to separate. One of the things I liked about the NBA analysis you did was that at the professional level, at least you're parsing out, you don't have team selection, you know, at least not as much about team selection. You're going to parse it directly by controlling for the quality of the players. In college sports, recruiting plays such an important role that his impact or her impact might go through as much player selection and retention as it does actual performance. But tell us what you find, because you weren't actually asking how much. You were like, which ones of these coaches were the best and how big a difference?
Yeah, so I used a method that I found on a blog. One of the things, the great things about sports analytics is frequently the best methods are on blogs, not in peer-reviewed research. That happens over and over again. Just great. Oh, for sure. So many passionate people about it. And there was a blogger, Ramzi Alamin, who basically tried to measure the value of coaches by, let's say, how good the players were the year before they played for the coach.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then we have a kind of a sense of how good, how much talent they are. I extended a little more because I didn't really understand why should you just do the year before they played for the coach. I used all information you had on other years. And another addition I made was adjust for age. Because if the player, you know, a year before was 20 and now they're 21, well, we'd expect them to be improving. And, you know, so first I just said, how much does age impact whatever advanced analytic you use, win shares per 48 or value over replacement? You know, what's the correlation with age? Then correct for that and say, how good were the players on average before they came to the team to say, okay, how much talent did this team have? Is it a perfect measure? No. There are issues. Tim Duncan played his entire career with Greg Popovich. There are some players who just were going to improve anyway. Maybe Michael Jordan was, you know, he wasn't as great age adjusted before Phil Jackson came. Was that really entirely due to Phil Jackson, or was he just on the verge of superstardom anyway? It's hard to know for sure. So I don't think it's a perfect measure, but it does still say that coaches are really valuable. And I think my number one, some of the coaches that come up really high, Stan Albeck, Jerry Sloan, Phil Jackson, Greg Popovich, Larry Bird, because Larry Bird's short tenure with the Pacers, they just did not have a lot of objective talent on those teams and they did really well. So that was interesting that he scores so highly.
Jumps out.
Mm-hmm. It jumps out because, you know, we don't usually think of him as a legendary coach. It was such a short period.
Also, he came and went so quickly.
Yeah.
Only man in the history of the NBA to win player MVP, coach MVP, and general manager of the year MVP. Larry Bird.
Yeah. I didn't realize that. And then Doug Moe, who wasn't even that great. His teams weren't that great. But I think he barely over 500 winning percent. But if you look at the talent on the team, very little talent that he did a lot with. And then, you know, one of the things that happens with this analysis is a lot of the coaches that had very high win percentages, like the recent short-term coaches for the Boston Celtics, Joe Mazzulla, and they go down a lot because the Boston Celtics clearly had a lot of talent. You know, David Blatt has a 67.5% winning percentage. I think it's the sixth highest win percentage of the modern era. Well, he coached LeBron James, so he comes at using this adjusting for player talent. He comes up as an average or even below average coach because the formula shows, okay, LeBron was already an amazing player before he showed up. But I think one of the things that I really found interesting about doing this is, okay, let's say we have a measure. It may not be perfect. We have some metric to measure coaches, how many wins a coach adds on a season, which I think is very high. Other scholars have found it very high.
Let's play the game one more time. And Eric, this has put you in a really tough spot, but you're up for challenges. So Eric, he's about to tell you he does some analysis to figure out what they do differently. Like, what is it that these most successful coaches do differently from the other guys? If you had to spin out some hypotheses, what are some that you would spin?
Good question. It would be probably whether it's, I'll call it a consistent rotation, or it's distribution of minutes, or it's something about maybe it's the right interaction of players playing together. Those would be my top three theories.
Okay.
Yeah, I actually tested those and they came out as not that important, in part because they're kind of small. Like every coach knows their best player, right? No coach is going to coach LeBron James and not play him a certain amount of minutes or, you know, so I think that, you know, not play Jokic enough or not play the real stars that had a lot of wins. So that seemed to not have a big impact.
Yeah, no. I wasn't referring necessarily to the best. I was referring to like, what does the coach do with players like 4 through 8 on the team? Like it's clear.
Yeah.
Like
yeah, but I think I think that then that makes a small, that has a smaller impact in part because they're not usually playing in the clutch moments, which are really much more important in the game. So it seems like that's not a huge difference. There was, so that there, I test a whole bunch of things. A lot of them didn't correlate. There was one thing that correlated enormously strong, and it was a very interesting thing that you could do very quickly with ChatGPT, is kind of speaking as an economist, you do kind of a fixed effects model on a metric of how often a player passes the ball when they're driving to the basket. And then you have, this is how much a player on average passes the ball. Here's how much they pass the ball when they're coached by this player. So again, it takes advantage of the fact that they weren't always coached by the player. So when the when the player is not coached by this person, they pass 60% of the time. Now they're passing 68% of the time. But you're using a regression and you're kind of finding the effects of coaches. And the effects of coaching there is enormous. Some coaches, players are just much more likely to pass the ball when they're driving the basket. And that was enormously correlated with coaching success. Now, it gets back to a statement famously made by Isaiah Thomas to Bill Simmons. He said, the secret of basketball is it's not about basketball. And what does that mean? Basketball has, more than almost any other sport, an incentives problem. Because what you see in basketball, and a lot of players have pointed this out, is the more points you score, generally the more money you're going to earn. So it shows up in salaries, but it also really shows up. I did an analysis with Facebook fans, how many Facebook fans a player has. And the only predictor of that is how many points per game they score. Like how much, anything else is just irrelevant. Their field goal percentage, their assists, their defense, it's all irrelevant. It's how many points they score. So basketball is this problem where players have an incentive to take as many shots as possible, even if they're hitting them at low percentages. And the great coaches, I believe, one of the main things a great coach does is they're able to get the players to act in the interest of the team, possibly at their own expense. It's kind of like being a great military leader. You're trying to get the players to think about their team more than themselves. And it's actually very interesting. If you look at the biographies of great coaches, there's a great book, The Culture Code by Daniel Coyne. And he profiles Greg Popovich, who comes out by my metric as a great coach, by just about any metric as a great coach. And they kind of say, what does he do? And it's very interesting how little of it is spent on the things that Eric was suggesting, you know, studying how much every player should play or, you know, X's and O's. So much of it is just building the culture and getting the players to become a family of sorts. So, you know, he'll take them out to these dinners and he'll talk about, what about your childhood? Tell me about your childhood. Giving them all hugs. Like, it kind of sounds corny, but I think it's so important in basketball that the players are able to basically do what may not be the best in their interest. If a player wants to maximize their career earnings, they want to be that crazy shooter, you know, scoring as many points as they can. They'll get a lot of fans. They'll get endorsement deals. They'll probably get a higher salary. And I think the great coaches are able to get the players to do much less of that.
So obviously, Eric, we gave you a very difficult question because nobody was ever going to come up with, they get their players to pass more. But there, and obviously Seth's bringing a lot of storytelling to his data analysis. He's matching some good data analysis with some serious storytelling, but it's a wonderful, now it's basically a hypothesis that people can pursue going forward.
Exactly.
And I think it's super intriguing. And I mean, there is this fundamental tension in group performance between individual accomplishment and sacrificing for the team. And this goes to the heart of that. We have to go. This has been a lot of fun. Seth, thanks, man, for making time. Wish you the best. Why don't you tell people the best way to find the book? It's self-published. How hard is it for people to find?
No, Who Makes the MBA on Amazon. Just search Who Makes the MBA on Amazon and you should be able to get a copy pretty easily.
Awesome. Awesome. All right. That is Seth Stevens-Davidowitz, data scientist, economist, author. He's got his third book out now. First time guest on Wharton Moneyball. Great talking to you, Seth. Great to see you.
Thanks so much for having me, Cade and Eric.
All right, man. That has been another hour, another show here on Wharton Moneyball. Appreciate you guys making it an hour with us. For my co-host, Eric Bradlow, for our two co-hosts in absentia, Shane Jensen and Adi Weiner, for our boss man producer, Maddie Datz, for our associate boss man, Dion Simpkins, for Kelly the intern, making things happen. Appreciate y'all listening. Come back and join us next time. Between now and then, enjoy your sports.